Jeff.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Healthcare on Committee, and we will not be hearing House Bill 2675. If there's anyone for House Bill 2675, we are not hearing that today because of the huge crowd on the other two issues that we're going to hear. So I'm going to start out with an informational hearing on the RAND HMA analysis of four financing models for healthcare in Oregon. And Senator Demarest, do you want to maybe make some opening remarks, and then we will have Chapman White, Nora Leibowitz, and Zachary Goldman come up to the dais. And then just for everyone to know that there is a hearing room C that is open for overflow today.
In the Galleria.
And in the Galleria. Okay. All right. Senator Demarest.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And members of the audience, I'm Michael Demarest. I represent District 23, Northeast, Southeast Portland. And thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to become a member of this committee for the next few minutes. I'm really excited about having this hearing initially to hear the results of the study that was done by the RAND Corporation that was commissioned by the legislature. This was a process that began back in 2013, where during that session we were looking at several different models for how can we do the most good for the most people in the most affordable and sustainable way in terms of their health care. And during that year, I remember we had a hearing on the health care for an earlier version of the Health Care for All Oregon bill. And on the same day, we heard about a proposal that came from Mr. De Laurentiis.
De Lorenzo,
listen to me. That was a sort of universal health care financed through a sales tax. And we decided that, you know, really we needed some outside expertise to study these different options and see what would be best for Oregon. And so we passed Senate Bill 3260, however, without funding, because we didn't have much money back then. We were in a little better shape in 2015, and so we passed House Bill 2828 at that time, which provided the funding to do this study. Pleased to say that that process culminated in the work that you're going to hear about in just a few minutes. And I could go on and on, but I'd rather have the people from the RAND Corporation come up, give the overview of the of their findings, and then allow committee members to pose questions to dig a little deeper into what we have learned and what are some options going forward. I think many of us are fully cognizant of the limitations in our current system, and that we need to really think out of the box if we are going to provide health care that's high quality, that's affordable, that's sustainable, and that covers everyone. So with that, Madam Chair, thank you.
You bet. Chapman White, Nora Leibowitz, and Zachary Goldman.
Chair, Lois Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Zachary Goldman. I'm the Economic Policy Advisor with Oregon Health Authority. And thank you, Senator Demarest, for that introduction. Pursuant to House Bill 3260 and the related HB 2828, the Oregon Health Authority posted a request for proposals and selected the RAND Corporation and subcontractor Health Management Associates to conduct the analyses. The RAND Corporation is a national leader in public policy analysis and quantitative modeling. And the Portland team of Health Management Associates has extensive familiarity with Oregon's health sector. In the final report, which was submitted to the legislature earlier this year, the contractors modeled three different scenarios and compared each to the status quo of today. Those three scenarios were, one, a single payer; two, a healthcare ingenuity plan, which would be a state-run managed competition program; and thirdly, an alternative marketplace plan, which would function as a public option available on the marketplace. The contractors will now describe those scenarios and their assessments of each option.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee, thank you for inviting me to speak today. For the record, my name is Chapin White. I'm a senior policy researcher with the RAND Corporation, and we'll be presenting the results of the study. So, as you all know better than I do, certainly, Oregon has been among the states that have played a leadership role in health reform at the state level. The study is part of a much longer conversation, and it is obviously not the end of the conversation. I wanted to start out by placing this in the long historical context in Oregon and among the other states that have led health reform efforts.
And just for the record, we now have had to open another overflow room, which is in hearing room E. So it's in hearing room C and hearing room E. Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay. And excuse me. We'll be discussing four options, as Zachary previewed. I'm going to go right to left. It'll actually flow better with the rest of the presentation. The first option is the status quo. The notion there is that the Affordable Care Act and the current healthcare system in Oregon continues along current trends. The second option is the public option, where the state would administer a health plan that would be offered in the marketplace to non-group enrollees and to small businesses who choose to purchase through the marketplace. That plan would be administered by the state and would compete with other private plans in the marketplace. The third option is the Healthcare Ingenuity Plan, or HCIP. HCIP would be an approach to achieving universal coverage in Oregon. It would enroll at all residents of Oregon, except Medicare beneficiaries and enrollees in certain federal plans, in a private plan with income-adjusted cost sharing. And we'll talk in more detail about that. The single-payer option would be another path to achieving universal coverage. The single-payer plan would include all residents of Oregon, including current Medicare beneficiaries and enrollees in federal plans. The single-payer option would have low cost sharing for lower-income individuals and households and very modest cost sharing for middle- and upper-income households. The single-payer plan would be administered by the state, and both HCIP and single-payer would be financed with existing federal funding plus new state tax revenues. The approach that we use to analyze and compare these four options involved three major steps. The first step was working with legislators and working with the Oregon Health Authority to fill in many of the details. The overview of each of these four options was spelled out in the legislation and then also in the request for proposals that came from OHA. But there were many details that had to be filled in, thinking through residency requirements, provider payment rates, and so on. So we had a long series of discussions and back and forth. And in general, the goal was to fill in the details in a way that was consistent with the spirit of the proposal. The second major step was to interview state leaders, mainly of agencies that would be directly involved in the options that are being discussed. And we also reviewed a large number of studies on single-payer plans, studies relating to state-based health reform in other states. And then the last major step was to use RAND's simulation models to project outcomes in the state of Oregon all in the year 2020 under these four options. So using these simulation models, what we set up was a situation where we could calculate and project costs, who would pay, how much would they pay, who would have health insurance coverage under four parallel universes reflecting these four policy options. Each of the options was compared using six major domains of outcomes. The first domain is financial barriers to accessing care. So that's getting at the notion that when patients are seeking out care, in many cases they have to pay out-of-pocket costs in the form of deductibles, coinsurance, copays, that may represent a barrier to accessing care, particularly for lower-income individuals. So the first domain that we used to evaluate these options was how did it impact financial barriers to accessing care. The second domain is the total costs of the healthcare system, and that's reflecting all of the payments to healthcare providers, all of the administrative expenses in operating the system. That's a much, much bigger dollar amount than the out-of-pocket payments by patients. That's another domain that we examined. The third domain is provider reimbursements. How much would physicians and hospitals and other healthcare providers be paid for the services they provide? The fourth domain is the availability of services, and that's getting at the notion that access to healthcare services depends not just on being able to pay any cost sharing as a patient, but it also depends on there being a provider who's available and willing to treat you. The fifth domain is statewide economic effects. There we looked at employment and impacts on gross state product. And I want to preview that the economic effects of all of these proposals are fairly minor, and the economic effects are really not the determinant of choosing among these policy options. And then the last domain is feasibility, and there are really two subdomains. One is legal regulatory hurdles, particularly waivers or federal law that could represent hurdles or possibly barriers to implementing these options. And the second subdomain of feasibility is what role would the state play? How much of a change or an expansion in the state's role would there be under each of these options? So let's move to some more specifics about how these options differ from each other. So each of the three policy options here is being compared with the status quo. So under the public option, the eligibility for the public option would be limited to individuals who can currently enroll in a marketplace plan. So that's individuals in non-group plans, individuals who work for a small employer who chooses to offer through the marketplace. It would not be available to individuals in Medicare, Medicaid, or who work for a large employer and have an affordable offer. Under HCIP, and the eligibility for the HCIP plan would be open to all Oregon residents, regardless of immigration status, as long as they're a permanent resident of the state of Oregon, they would be eligible for and enrolled in HCIP. The major carve-out in eligibility for HCIP is current Medicare beneficiaries and enrollees in the Federal Employee Plan, the VA, the Indian Health Service, would all stay in those federal programs. Under single-payer, eligibility for the plan would include all residents of Oregon, regardless of immigration status, and it would also roll in current Medicare beneficiaries as well as enrollees in those federal plans. In terms of the plans that would be offered under public option, there would be a state-administered plan offered in the marketplace alongside the current private plans. HCIP you can think of as similar to the marketplace in that there's a competing set of plans offering standardized benefits, but HCIP would be expanded to take the place of current employer-sponsored plans, the current Medicaid program, as well as the current non-group market. And then in the single-payer plan, there would be a single state-run plan that would enroll all permanent residents of Oregon. The scope of benefits would be the same across all three options. They would include essential health benefits as defined in the Affordable Care Act. In terms of cost sharing, the public option would follow the ACA cost sharing reduction schedule. So the deductibles, copays, coinsurance would be adjusted based on a household's income the same way marketplace plans and the cost sharing there are currently set. underage kids. This wasn't specified in the legislation or in the RFP, but under HCIP, the way we modeled HCIP was that cost sharing would be adjusted based on a household's income in the same way marketplace plans are under the ACA. So a family with income of 250% or above would be in a high deductible plan with an actuarial value of 70%. As a family's income falls below 250%, the cost sharing would fall as well. And families who, under the status quo, would be eligible for Medicaid would be in, under HCIP, they would be in plans with minimal or no cost sharing. Under the single payer, all families in with incomes below 250% of the federal poverty level would face no cost sharing. Families above that would be enrolled in a plan with an actuarial value of 96%, which means that of the total expenditures on covered benefits, 96% of those expenditures would be paid by the single payer plan. The remaining 4% on average would be paid by enrollees. But that 4% would only be applying to families above 250% of the poverty level. This graphic is a visual illustration of how coverage would differ under each of these three options relative to the status quo. So the status quo is the rightmost set of columns. At the bottom, we have Medicare and the other major federal programs. The next, the largest bar stack in the, under the status quo is employer-sponsored group coverage. On top of that is the Medicaid program, and then on top of that is non-group coverage, and then at the very top, the black bar is the uninsured in Oregon. If you move from the status quo to the public option, there's relatively little change in where individuals get their health insurance coverage. There would be a fairly modest decline in the number of uninsured residents in Oregon. Non-group enrollees would have a new option available to them. Workers for small firms who choose to offer health insurance would have a new option available to them. But enrollees in Medicaid would remain where they are. Enrollees in large employer-sponsored group coverage would remain where they are, and enrollees in the other federal programs would remain where they are. HCIP would represent a much more substantial change for all residents except those in Medicare and the other federal programs. They would be moved into the HCIP program. So that would take current Medicaid enrollees, non-group enrollees, the uninsured, and all enrollees in employer-sponsored group plans and move them into the HCIP system. Single payer would represent the largest shift in sources of coverage. All residents of Oregon would be moved into the state-administered single-payer plan. In terms of financing, the sources of financing for the three options differs. The first key thing to point out is that under all of these options and under the status quo, there's a significant amount of funding flowing from the federal government into Oregon to finance health care. Those federal funds would continue under any of the options. Under the public option, the federal funding for marketplace tax credits and cost-sharing reductions would continue as under the current system, and that combined with premiums paid by individuals enrolled in those plans would finance the operations of the public option.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Clarify something for me. Under HCIP, what would happen to the money that's currently being spent by employers who do provide employer-based health insurance, either through a self-insured model, ERISA model, or through standard small or large group coverage? Where would those dollars go?
That would be savings to employers who currently offer health benefits, and that's a significant saving.
Do you
want
to
put the other?
Yeah.
If you're going to get to it later, that's cool.
Numbers.
I can wait. That's cool.
We have numbers coming up. That give a little more detail on
that's
that.
That's fine. Thank you.
Yeah, so that's a source of financing that goes away or is dramatically reduced under HCIP. Excuse me. Under HCIP, a new source of financing would be the state sales tax. That was specified in the RFP and in the legislation describing the options. under single payer, employers would no longer be paying premiums for their workers. Individuals would no longer be paying premiums, but there would be two major new sources of revenues: a new state payroll tax and an increase in state income tax revenues. The other key feature of the single payer plan that
Senator Beyer.
The payroll tax, is that on the employer or the employee side?
That's on the employer side.
Employer side. Yeah.
The single payer, as we modeled it, includes a the state is setting payment rates, and we assume that the state would reduce provider payment rates below the current level. It's not technically a source of financing, but it makes the financing add up.
Insurance may see a savings in those who
In terms, this slide gets at the same financing question, but gives some dollar amounts. So I'd like to start at the bottom. The bottom represents total payments for health care services provided to residents of Oregon. And these are all projections to the year 2020. So in the year 2020, under the status quo, we project that about $36 billion would be spent on healthcare plus administrative expenses associated with that healthcare for the residents of Oregon. And the first key thing to note about the three options is that there's some movement in the total payments for healthcare services in Oregon, but those movements in the total payments are relatively minor. Going from the status quo, adding the public option in the marketplace reduces total payments for healthcare somewhat. That's on the bottom row. Moving to HCIP increases total payments somewhat. Moving to the single payer, as we specified it, would leave total payments for healthcare more or less unchanged. Where these three options differ more substantially from the status quo is in where where the financing is coming from. And if you look at HCIP, this is getting to the question of what would employers be paying, would there be savings to employers under HCIP. If you look at the premiums paid by the top row, premiums paid by households plus employers and out-of-pocket payments by patients when they're receiving services, under the status quo, that's about $14 billion. Moving to the public option would reduce that somewhat because the public option would be somewhat less expensive. But moving to HCIP, those premium payments and out-of-pocket payments would be reduced by about half to $7 billion. And much of that savings accrues to employers who are no longer paying the premiums for the core medical benefits for their workers. Moving to single payer, premium payments are eliminated entirely. Out-of-pocket payments are also reduced substantially, and so premium payments by households and employers plus out-of-pocket spending is reduced to less than $1 billion. So under HCIP and under single payer, the savings on premium payments by households and employers and savings on out-of-pocket is replaced with new state outlays. So the new state outlays under HCIP, or I shouldn't say new, total state outlays under HCIP would be around $10 billion, and that would be financed by the new state sales tax. State outlays under single payer would be about $15 billion, and that would be financed by the payroll tax plus an increase in state income tax revenues. So the key thing that's going on here, and we've circled the two cells to highlight here, is that this is shifting from status quo to single payer would represent a major change in where people get their health insurance, how health insurance is financed. But in terms of financing, there's a dramatic reduction in premium payments and out-of-pocket payments, and there's a corresponding increase in state outlays. The total payments for healthcare remains more or less unchanged.
Okay, we've designated 40 minutes for this section and then 40 minutes for the next. I want to make sure that I'd rather get through this and then ask questions, okay?
Okay.
I'm okay. So let's keep going. In terms of the delivery of services under all three of these options and under the status quo, private providers and integrated delivery systems would be providing care. Under none of these scenarios would the state be directly employing physicians or hospital employees to provide services. In terms of provider payments, we specified that the public option plan would be paying providers following Medicare's rate schedule. And on top of that, we specified that the public option would be set up in a way where providers, if they wanted to participate in any of the plans offered to state employees, they would also have to participate in the public option. And the notion there is not to be draconian or to be anti-provider, but the notion instead is if the public option is going to be attracting enrollment, it has to be able to offer a competitive premium. And to be able to offer a competitive premium, it has to be able to either pay providers lower rates or have lower administrative expenses or achieve savings in some other way. The most direct way we could envision for the public option to offer a lower cost plan and to be competitive with the other plans offered in the exchange was for it to follow the Medicare rate schedule and to be able to offer a broad provider network. Under HCIP, the private plans would be negotiating their payment rates with providers the same way they are under the current system. Under single payer, the state would be setting payment rates for providers. We assumed that the state would set those payment rates so that on average provider payment rates would be 10% below the status quo, where the status quo it represents a mixture of payment rates where Medicare and Medicaid tend to be relatively low. Private plans tend to pay relatively high rates. The status quo average is somewhere in the middle of those two. Under the single payer, the notion was that the state would set its payment rates 10% below the status quo average. So above Medicare and Medicaid, but well below current commercial payments. In terms of administration, the state would play the role of receiving premiums, financing care under the public option. Under HCIP, the state would be paying premiums to private health plans. Under the single payer, the state would be administering, would be overseeing private contractors who administer the details of the plan. I'd like to turn to Nora Leibowitz.
For the record, my name is Nora Leibowitz with Health Management Associates, and you're in luck because this slide and the next slide have great overlap, so I'm going to not have to do double. So thinking about the implementation issues, the HMA team was greatly involved in the things that couldn't be modeled using the RAND modeling, such as how much work is it going to take to make any of these things happen. The short answer for public option is that it's relatively easy to implement in that it's a pretty small change, all things considered, adding a health plan option. The state already has provides administration of coverage for multiple populations, including PEB and OEB and the Medicaid population. So from that side, much of the work would be the legislature authorizing this and the state working to identify which functions it would provide and which contractors would provide. For HCIP and single payer, the implementation is much more significant because, as Chapin mentioned, both of these options are a significant change from status quo in terms of how healthcare is administered. For both, there would be a need to get approvals from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, both on the Medicaid side as well as on the private market side through a 1332 waiver for the use of premium tax credits. And then additionally for single payer, for the Medicare portion, which I would note is not something that that CMS does really at all, other than in one state, and that was that was a long time ago. And then similarly on the implementation side for single payer, we anticipate that ERISA would be a potential challenge. So to get through that, either some negotiation with the federal government would be required, and possibly federal legislation. Similarly, in terms of the amount of change, having a public option adds an option for individuals in the private marketplace. It adds a population to what the state administers, but otherwise, it's not a very large system change in terms of what the state would be taking on. For both HCIP and single payer, there would be a significantly larger set of activities with centralized administration, and then much more, for lack of a better term, control over the collection and dispersal of funds for healthcare. And I think actually this is one of the most key points on the non-modeling side, which is that for both HCIP and single payer, the really big change is that in a way that doesn't exist now in the state, having the ability to use the funds that support healthcare for all Oregonians would give significant leverage to the state to design the rules for the delivery system. And this study didn't ask us to, and we didn't look at the delivery system changes that would or could be made under any of these programs. But it should be no surprise to anyone that if you have more direct control of the funds, you have more leverage to make those system changes that that Oregon has been discussing for a long time in terms of the benefits of coordinated care model or value-based purchasing, et cetera. And that's something that the public option doesn't provide that. And then savings in health administrative costs. There is a $100 million or so in public option savings, mostly related to the structure of the public option. And that just assumes that the state costs aren't different for this population than the administrative costs for the programs that the state runs now. For single payer, there are significant administrative savings, but most of them accrue to the federal government because any savings that that are for the populations currently covered by Medicare and as also Medicaid, the federal government is a big for Medicare is the stakeholder in terms of the funding, and then on the Medicaid side, anytime we save money in Medicaid, the feds benefit from that as well. Although there is about $100 million in state savings. And then on the single payer side, on the HCIP side, there's not as much savings, and some of that has to do with the way that those plans are administered. On the next slide, it really is a similar set of issue points. So I think from there, we can go on to our what's the bottom line slide.
Great. So just to wrap up, in terms of enrollment, the public option would increase enrollment in health insurance somewhat. HCIP and single payer by design would achieve universal coverage. In terms of financial barriers to accessing care, they would be reduced somewhat under the public option. Under HCIP, they would also be reduced somewhat. Single payer would dramatically reduce financial barriers to accessing care, especially for lower income residents. In terms of the system costs, the public option would reduce the total cost of the healthcare system somewhat. HCIP would increase system costs, and that's mainly from moving Medicaid enrollees and the uninsured into private plans, paying providers private rates. The single payer, as we modeled it, would result in relatively little change in system costs. The single payer and HCIP would have a fairly large impact on who bears those costs, and both HCIP and single payer would reduce costs borne by lower income households and increase costs borne by higher income households. that's something we can talk more about in questions if you'd like. In terms of provider reimbursements, they would be reduced under public options, increased under HCIP, and decreased under single payer. That's not inherent to single payer, but that's the way we specified the plan to make the finances work out better. The availability of services would change relatively little under the public option. They would improve somewhat under HCIP because of more generous provider payments. Service availability would worsen under single payer. There, under single payer, what's happening there is there's a substantial increase in the population that has health insurance. There's a substantial reduction in cost sharing among the among those with insurance. That's going to lead more patients to seek out care, and at the same time, provider reimbursements are being decreased. We expect that will lead to some congestion in the healthcare system as more patients seek out care, and there's the same provider supply with reduced reimbursements. In terms of impacts on the state economy, they're relatively minor. And then in terms of feasibility, the public option is a fairly straightforward extension of the state's current activities and is feasible without necessarily requiring a waiver from the federal government. HCIP and single payer are more challenging on the feasibility side, both in terms of a major change or expansion in the state's role. Single payer also runs into a very likely ERISA challenge and could require either federal legislation or navigating the ERISA challenge in a way that is a little hard to see without federal legislation. That's the end of our prepared remarks.
Wonderful. Okay. Senator Steiner Hayward.
I have more questions than I can probably even ask here. So at some point I'd love to talk more with you guys. I think I'm actually going to start from the slide back, so if you want to go back one slide. Can you explain some of the assumptions behind, for example, why provider reimbursement would change or how it would change the employment or increase the GDP or some of them are more obvious. The feasibility piece is pretty obvious. The enrollment piece is obvious. But could you talk a little bit about those things, the assumptions under there?
Yep. So let's start with provider reimbursement under the public option. Let me start by saying that you could imagine the public option being set up in a number of different ways. And Oregon had two co-op plans offered in the marketplace. That's one version of a public option. That there are also coordinated care organizations. That's another version of the public option. Our sense was we had many discussions on the study team about this. My sense is that for the public option to make much of a difference, it has to have some sort of head start over the plans that are currently offered in the marketplace. One way to give a plan a head start in terms of keeping premiums down and attracting enrollment is to set it up so that it can piggyback onto the Medicare fee schedule. That does two things. One is it allows the plan to pay providers lower rates than are typically paid by private plans in Oregon. It also allows the public option plan to piggyback onto Medicare's administrative contractors and incur lower administrative expenses than if the plan were negotiating payment rates every year and having to administer a complicated rate schedule and system on its own. So. That's not inherent to the notion of a public option, but that was a version of the public option that would attract enrollment, that would make some difference to the Oregon healthcare system, and that's why provider reimbursements are decreased and that under the public option. That's also why total system costs are decreased under the public option.
Mm-hmm.
Provider reimbursements under HCIP would increase. There, what's happening is if you take current Medicaid enrollees and the uninsured and move them into private plans paying providers private rates, that will tend to increase total system costs and increase provider reimbursements. So that under HCIP, the two red cells, the two increases, those are for the same reason. That's because the uninsured and Medicaid enrollees are being moved into private plans paying providers private rates. Under the single payer provider reimbursement, the way we specified the single payer plan, provider reimbursements would decrease relative to the status quo. That is not inherent to the notion of single payer. We did some modeling of versions of the single payer where provider reimbursements would be kept at the same level on average as the status quo. That's a perfectly reasonable approach to single payer. That would tend to increase the total costs of the healthcare system if the single payer model didn't include a decrease in provider reimbursements. So that's a specification it's not inherent to the notion of single payer. But the fact that provider reimbursements are decreasing while at the same time there's a large expansion in coverage and lower cost sharing, those two roughly offset each other and results in total system costs being comparable to the status quo. In terms of the state economy, there are a couple. First, let me back up and say the clearest way that health reform can impact the state economy is if there is a change like a Medicaid expansion or the ACA that results in a new flow of federal funds into the state that will tend to boost the state economy, boost employment. None of the options that we analyzed resulted in a major change in the flow of federal funds into the state, and that was because the premise was these options should all be budget neutral from the federal government's perspective, and that's in keeping with the notion of state Medicaid waivers and 1332 waivers, and that's the starting premise is that they should be budget neutral for the federal government. So if there's no new major flow of federal funds, or if there's no major loss of federal funds, the impacts on the state economy are going to be relatively minor. The impacts that we do observe come one of the features of these proposals that doesn't come out in these slides, but is captured in the full report, is that lower income families will tend to be paying less for health care especially under single payer than under the status quo. Higher income families will be paying more for health care under single payer than they would be under the status quo. And there's a transfer of buying power from higher income families to lower income families, especially under the single payer. That will actually tend to boost the economy because lower income households will tend to spend more of their available income compared to higher income families. At the same time, under the single payer option, there's some reduction in employment in the health insurance sector. There's also the fact that providers are receiving lower reimbursement rates for the services they provide. That will tend to dampen employment in GSP. Those two effects roughly net out under the single payer. Under HCIP, you have some transfer of buying power from higher income families to lower income families, and at the same time you have providers receiving higher reimbursement rates for the services they provide. Those two both will tend to boost the state economy, but again the effects are relatively minimal. There's a number of ways that health reform could impact the state economy that are more speculative, possibly more important, and that were not included in the analysis. And those could include if there are any improvements in health status and the availability of individuals to participate in the labor force, that could boost the state economy. There could also be an influx or possibly an outflow of state population. We didn't consider or estimate any of those impacts.
I'm sure other people have questions, so I'm happy
Senator Dambro.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. I neglected to mention that as this study was being designed in its early implementation, your committee administrator was actually the point person at the Oregon Health Authority. And I really want to thank Oliver for his work on that. It was great. So I have a couple of questions. And one, just following up on the issue of the provider reimbursement, you know, I think one of the things that one of the goals, at least, you know, with the single payer plan is to increase access to primary care and to get more people using primary care, which is presumably lower cost, right? And I'm wondering if that was taken into account, if there was an uptick. I'll just ask a few because they're kind of related. And I'm wondering if I guess there would be a concern if providers were seeing you know, a reduction in their reimbursements, a fear that they might leave the state, go to other states. How does Oregon's compensation compare to other states for general insurance kinds of plans? And then Nora, you know, you raised the point of you know, the ability for you know, the state to use its purchasing power, its to leverage. Were you thinking about drug costs? Were you thinking about streamlining paperwork? You know, that kind of thing. It seems like there's a potential for real savings there.
That's great. Okay, so I'll address the first two questions. So on the provider reimbursement, so the assumption, the specification for the single payer plan was that provider reimbursements would be set 10% below the status quo on average, but that could be achieved through many different combinations of payment schedules, and achieving that 10% reduction relative to the status quo could be consistent with boosts or possibly no change for the for primary care providers, and at the same time, larger than 10% reductions for specialist physicians. The reductions for provider reimbursements could also be weighted more heavily to the hospital sector and could not be affecting the physician sector. We didn't get into any of there are many combinations for achieving that 10% overall reduction and consistent with the state being in the role of the buyer of healthcare and having increased leverage, you could imagine that the state under the single payer system would choose to leave primary care reimbursements where they are, or possibly even increase them relative to the status quo, and at the same time push provider reimbursements down for other types of providers.
And if I could jump in, and presumably a number of physicians would not have to have as many office staff, right, because it would be a more streamlined sort of paperwork system. I don't know if that was taken into account.
That's a great question. So, and we had a long discussion yesterday that centered a lot on how this would impact physician practice and practices and administrative expenses. And the short answer is it depends on how the single payer plan is set up. It's conceivable that the single payer plan could be set up in a way that streamlines operations for physician practices and for hospitals. It's also possible that you could imagine most of the administrative expenses, or even all of them, continuing more or less as they are. And it gets to the question of under the single payer option, would providers continue to have to bill for each service they provide? I expect that the answer would be yes. It's conceivable you could put hospitals on a global budget and just tell them, here's your budget at the beginning of the year, go do the best you can. That raises a number of issues with hospitals then losing the incentive to increase their output and provide services to individuals in their catchment area. So the single payer administrative processes, I think implicit in the study is that they would continue roughly in line with current administrative activities by providers, where they have to bill for the services they are providing. They have to report on their quality of care. They obviously have to meet credentialing requirements. It would be streamlined somewhat if they no longer have to deal with a bunch of different separate plans. But those administrative expenses, it's hard to imagine going to a system where they would go away entirely. In terms of provider reimbursements and how they compare to other states, one thing that emerged in the course of doing the study is that private health plans in Oregon stand out for paying providers generously relative to both Medicare and Medicaid in the state of Oregon, but also relative to private plans operating in other states. And there's a number of different data points that support that general conclusion. So it's an important piece of context when we talk about the possibility of decreasing provider reimbursements in single payer. The notion there isn't going from providers receiving reimbursements that are below average nationwide to even further below average nationwide. It would more be the case that providers in Oregon would go from being reimbursed more generously than the national average to more in line with the national average.
Yes, one final, because we're running out of time.
Okay. If you could just scoot back to slide 10, that'd be great. I'm confused about another aspect about this. When you look, one of the pieces that I don't see really addressed here is you say, for example, if you look at the, and I sound like I'm being really negative. I'm not. I think this is fascinating, and I'm super interested in this, so please don't take this way. But you list about the premiums going down under the HCIP and the single payer, but given the financing mechanisms, wouldn't people be paying in other ways that were not directly associated? I mean, do we have a sense of what, because all of those state outlays, or the vast majority of those state outlays, would come from those taxes that being levied, and those are levied on, in the case of single payer, either payroll tax and sales tax, or in the case of HCIP, a sales tax. So do we have a sense of how that would average out per Oregonian compared to the premiums and the out-of-pocket expenses that they're currently paying?
Yes. There's a number of charts and tables and figures in the full report.
Cool.
Under the single payer, there's a dramatic shift away from payments of premiums and out of pocket to payments through the payroll tax and increased income taxes. In the aggregate, the total amounts paid are about the same, but for different types of households, for different types of individuals, there's going to be some fairly dramatic changes in how much people pay for health care and how they pay. There's a number of tables that quantify some of those.
I'll take a look at the report. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you so much. It would be great if OHA and the governor and the legislature could come and see, could one of these models really be implemented in the state of Oregon. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
All right. With that, we'll close the informational on the RAND HMA analysis, and we'll open an informational on Senate Bill 1046. I know it's listed as a public hearing, but we wanted the opportunity for the public to be able to give information. So so we'll have Senator Dambrough, Mary Lou Henrich, and Paul Gorman start us off. Do you want?
I'll just do it from here, Madam Chair. Just I'll turn it over to my good friends there who can talk about this bill. This bill is this year's version of the Health Care for All Oregon Act, and it is exploring that single-payer model, and it, I think, has a lot of merits to it. And that's all I'll say at this point, and let them give you the details. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, Senators. My name is Mary Lou Henrich, as most of you know. I'm a retired nurse and public health administrator with a 45-year career working to improve health and lives of Oregon residents, especially the poorest and most vulnerable. I've often visited you during my tenure at Multnomah County, Care Oregon, and the Oregon Public Health Institute. When I retired in 2014, I breathed a sigh of relief. My days of rushing to Salem to inform and try to persuade you about many health-related issues were finally over. From prevention policies and funding to disease treatments, healthcare financing, delivery system reform, I believed I'd done my part. And when asked to continue formal advocacy efforts, I said, no, I'm retired and leaving this work to the next generation. I remarried, however, spent time with grandchildren, did all kinds of things supporting women legislative candidates, traveling around, focusing on my own family and neighborhood, including social justice issues through my church. St. Michael and All Angels Episcopal is a diverse congregation that puts faith into action and is an active member of Healthcare for All Oregon Coalition, HCAO. I was approached several times to become more involved in their efforts, advocating for publicly funded universal health care for everyone who resides in Oregon. I made some donations, but I kept my distance and continued to say no. After marrying David Still from Eastern Oregon and finding out he was active in HCAO Union County, I decided maybe this was the time to stop whining about the unfair, ineffective, expensive, and unsustainable healthcare mess we find ourselves in and join the growing grassroots movement to establish universal healthcare in Oregon. Our current healthcare non-system, with its ever-rising cost to individuals, employers, employees, local, state, and federal governments, is unsustainable. The health and happiness of our children, grandchildren, and future generations is in serious jeopardy. So before I quite knew what I was volunteering for, I found myself joining St. Michael's HCAO group, becoming a member of the Faith Caucus, and finally a representative on the HCAO board. With legislative leadership of Senator Dembro and others of you, HCAO continues its efforts to develop and advance a workable concept for publicly funded universal health care system for all Oregon residents. Senate Bill 1046 is the latest iteration. The well-informed panelists who will speak today after me will present the basic framework of the bill, what it is, why we need it, how it will work, and why the time to make it a reality is now. You will hear from healthcare providers, business owners, representatives of labor, academic healthcare leaders, patients, health policy experts, and social justice advocates. Each panelist will make a very short presentation because of the time on various aspects of the issues that we face as we work to achieve our goal. We realize that you will have questions and or concerns that we cannot fully answer today. HCAO and its individual members and 120 member organizations from across the state stand ready to continue the dialogue with you and your fellow legislators in the coming months. As my longtime mentor Tom Higgins told me many years ago, Mary Lou, your job is to speak truth to power. Now that I am retired and no longer paid by any special interest, I believe I can truly do this. That's why I'm here today. The only answer is a publicly funded, single-payer, universal healthcare system for all Oregon residents. The time for remodeling is past. It's time to think boldly and rebuild. Thank you for allowing us the opportunity today, and feel free to contact me or any of my fellow advocates.
And we know how to contact you.
Okay.
Thank you
and
so much.
If you forget, I'll help you remember.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thanks for hearing us from Healthcare for All Oregon. My name is Paul Gorman. I'm an Oregon physician practicing internal medicine in the state for 33 years. I speak today for myself and Healthcare for All Oregon, not for my employer, Oregon Health Science University. I'm also a member of Physicians for a National Health Program, advocating for a universal health care that is publicly funded and privately delivered, also referred to as single payer or Medicare for All. My task this afternoon is to outline in general terms what it would mean for Oregon to adopt such a single-payer system as proposed in Senate Bill 1046. Fortunately, my task should be a simple one because a single-payer system is far simpler, far more efficient, and far more humane than the complicated maze of insurance plan rules and requirements that patients and families, physicians and hospitals, all of us, now find so difficult to navigate. What we're talking about here is simple: publicly funded, privately delivered health care for everyone in Oregon in a system that is affordable, transparent, and accountable. We all chip in on the cost, and we all have a say in the coverage. We're talking about a system in which a single public agency organizes the financing of health care, and healthcare delivery continues primarily as it does now through private clinicians, hospitals, and systems. A couple of questions to answer. First, who's covered? Everyone. Everyone who resides in Oregon or pays taxes in Oregon is covered in this system. Universal coverage is simpler and it's better. For all concerned, for patients, clinicians, for hospitals, we no longer need to ask, are you covered? The answer is yes. Dozens of countries achieve better health outcomes at lower cost than the United States does. And all of them have this thing in common. They have universal coverage. Second, what is covered? Coverage is comprehensive, including all medically necessary mental health care, dental health care, and physical health, emphasizing primary care and preventive care, and inclusive of complementary and alternative modalities. Of course, there must be limits. Decisions have to be made about where to draw the line, what to include and what not to include. Under the proposed single plan, there are three important differences on how these decisions are made. First, these coverage decisions will be made by a public agency with broad public input, with transparency and accountability. Second, these decisions will be evidence-based, considering cost-effectiveness and the best scientific evidence. And Oregon is a leader in this regard. Third, and this is a major advance in making the system manageable and efficient, there's just one set of rules. No longer do patients, clinicians, and hospitals have to navigate dozens or hundreds of different sets of rules for what's covered and what is not. There's just one set of rules for everyone based on scientific evidence with public input and accountability. It's been estimated that every physician practice will save tens of thousands of dollars per physician per year because of this reduction in paperwork. Third, who decides? There are two important choices to talk about here. First, who decides where you get your care and from whom? Second, who decides which services you will receive? The proposed plan empowers patients to make these choices. In our current system, patients do not have free choice. Employers choose which plans to offer. Insurance plans decide which doctors and which services will be included in the network. And the insurers dictate which hospitals, insurance plans dictate which services and which treatments will be covered. In the single player plan, everyone is free to go to the doctor or the hospital of their choice. There's no in-network and out-of-network. Everything's included. In the current system, physicians and patients' hands are tied, sometimes in arbitrary ways, when it comes to treatment decisions. In the single-payer system, it explicitly respects the primacy of the patient-provider relationship in making these decisions. Last question, who pays? Right now, we are actually paying enough to afford a universal coverage single-payer system. We're just not getting one. In the United States, we spend nearly $10,000 per capita on health care, while other nations spend roughly half that or less. More importantly, public spending on health care in the United States is roughly 64% of total spending, which means that public dollars alone are enough to finance universal care under a single-payer system if we can eliminate the wasteful administrative expense that results from our current complex financing system. More importantly, what is increasingly hurting Oregonians are the rising out-of-pocket expenses. Rising premiums are only part of the story. Higher costs for out-of-network services, co-payments, deductibles, and co-insurance mechanisms to shift an increasing burden of the cost of care to individuals beyond what they already pay in premiums. A single-payer system will put an end to that. With no co-pays, no deductibles, no co-insurance, no more bankruptcy. No longer will every Oregonian be one illness away from financial ruin. Can Oregon do this alone? Certainly we can. Senate Bill 1046 includes provisions for obtaining federal waivers, for preserving federal health care dollars, and for providing and paying for care across state lines. Others and the bill itself can provide the details. Suffice it to say here that, as we have in the past, Oregon can lead the way to effective, affordable, quality care for all within our borders. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And you've been doing pretty well keeping on. Okay. So now we have 11 more people, and so that'll mean about 3 minutes apiece. I've got my stopwatch here with my phone, so we'll call up Ron Lowe, Chun Wei Chi, and Tracy McEwen. Do those next three. Please start.
Okay. Good morning. Thank you for inviting testimony on the subject of healthcare. After reading the written testimonials, it's clear to all of us in this room that our current system is unsustainable. It's also clear that we already understand the reasons and we understand the details of how to fix this. Today is a special day in that 21 years ago, my mom and I were getting ready to go to a trip on Denmark to see a furniture show, and it was my dad's birthday. We didn't get to do that because our factory burned to the ground in Corvallis. So our family-owned business with 65 employees burned to the ground, and it was with your help, with the state of Oregon, that we received an OBDF loan to rebuild our factory. Without that loan, our family business would have been done. With the loan, we rebuilt the factory and continued in business. Today, after 35 years, we've spent more than $30 million in local payroll checks in Albany, Corvallis, $120 million of revenue into Oregon, and $180 million in payroll. The point of all this is that you have the ability to do incredible things with programs at the state. You have the ability to make our lives better, or in some cases our business will fail without your help. So the question today is really, are you willing to lead the way to a nonprofit, single-payer health system? If you are, we're sure that you should expect tremendous resistance from the insurance companies, from the drug companies. You know, if you're willing to lead, you're going to have enormous obstacles to overcome. Or are you going to support the current system, the status quo, the for-profit insurance companies, which are very inefficient at providing health care services, but are very efficient at transferring billions of dollars from our individuals into the corporate funds? Last, are you going to wait until the system collapses, which is obvious and evident? And with all due respect, that's what we're anxious to know.
Thank you so much.
Good afternoon. My name is Chun Wei Chi. I'm professor of public health at OSU, and I also teach healthcare system and health insurance. And also, I had served as a consultant for Taiwan's National Health Insurance Administration for over a decade, so I can share some of my experience. And actually, 2 years ago, I testified in front of this committee for the predecessors, SB 630. I will not repeat all the advantages that my colleague already did. I also have a longer written version of testimony. And what I want to emphasize today is, since 2 years ago I testified, there's a lot of things changed. We know our healthcare system is a social institution, is not just an industry. And it serves multiple purposes besides promoting population health, also promote social coherence, promote social security, as well as promote social capitals. And one of the legacies of this country is to provide every single Americans the opportunity to be able to success. And to be able to success, two essential conditions that provided by the society are important: education and health. And since 2 years ago, I testified here, we have seen the slowly erosion of this, particularly with the new administration. Their plan, their intention to reduce the social support on both education and health, as well as an environment, will create two fronts of attack on the population's health. On the one hand, increasing the risk of people exposing to all kinds of environmental and social risks to become ill. At the same time, reducing people's access, ability to use health care. And therefore, I see the urgency that compared with 2 years ago to implement soon of a single-payer systems. And also, I was in the overflow room listening to all the report of the RAND Corporation's study. And several important factors were left out in the RAN study. For example, the impact of a single-payer system's ability to promote population health, as well as underestimate of administrative cost. With my personal professional experience, I know how a single-payer system is capable of reducing the administrative cost. And finally, I just want to comment that just when the more and more Americans are shifting their perception about healthcare as a basic right rather than as a commodity, again, the current administration and together with Congress try to privatize and attempt to privatize many of our public health system, including the notion they're contemplating even the notion of privatized Medicare. And just this early this year, JAMA, the General American Medical Association, published an editorial, advocate all physicians to speak in a single voice, including physicians who are in the Congress, that healthcare should be a basic right. And this is a huge change of the AMA's position. They have long-term resist to have a single payer, but this is a dramatic change. Together with that, just this month, the Catholic Church, in its National Catholic Reporter, has an editorial say the same thing. Healthcare should be a basic right rather than a commodity. And many of my colleagues, they testified that single-payer system has the ability not only controlling cost, but also promote population health, improving quality. So the real question we should ask is not whether we can afford a single-payer system. The real question is, can we afford the current system? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Please don't clap. We don't clap in a public hearing. All right. Or yell or do any of that.
Howdy. I'm sorry. I will read from my statement and try to. Yes. But you, so I should explain to everybody that I have had a stroke, so I'm not really fast, but I want to be, want to cover everything. So thank you, Chairman, and thank you for the committee. My name is Tracy McEwen, and I'm from Lincoln City on the coast. So I had my stroke at the gym. I was about halfway through and feeling somewhat sickly, but nothing too profound. I didn't want to be sick in front of anybody, so I retired to be by myself in the bathroom stall. I was trying to hide. Yes, thankfully at first, but I wonder now. I didn't have any pain. Perhaps pain might accompany thoughts that something was very wrong. I remained in the bathroom for perhaps an hour and a half before trying to marshal my energy and make my way to the front door. It wasn't that busy, so all I had to do was try and avoid one of the owners, Silky, and my intention was to drive home about a mile from the gym. She stopped me right away. She called 911 right away. She was on to me. If she hadn't stopped me, the speculation is that I would have died. It makes sense. I'm, of course, a usual guy. So most people do die. Again, I didn't have any pain, so my usual thoughts were interrupted, and pain which might have indicated something more profound. If I had realized that I might be having a stroke, I would have been much more inclined to try and do something quickly. This was in June of 2011. I remember seeing my good friends Kelly and Faith at the hospital. Kelly would later confide in me that I was trying to speak, but obviously was having a great deal of difficulty. I knew that I was a candidate for trying to be good to myself because I couldn't afford health insurance. So I walked 5 or 6 days a week and about 3 to 5 miles on a somewhat regular basis. I usually went to the gym about 3 times a week and had done so for several years. I had a healthy lifestyle, but I had undiagnosed high blood pressure. It was referred to as the silent killer, and now I understand that. I was lucky. My sister was wonderful beyond words and wrote a book about her experience caring for me after my event. My friends were remarkable. I remained mostly in a drug-induced coma for 27 days at OHSU. Today, I continue to get better. I remember asking my physical therapist about 3 years into this episode, was I wrong to experience feeling better this late? I was told that I would recover health-wise, but yes, what I might expect to achieve in the first 6 months. She, being a doctor herself, said, what the hell do doctors know? So it's difficult to explain, but when one is learning to speak, you grasp words and struggle to say them, but this process couples the thinking with the physical. So I find the brain remarkable. I have learned a new word, neuroplasticity. And yes, the brain creates new pathways to accomplish what it did before. I had an additional challenge to learn the physical aspect regarding speech in terms of forming words, but also the mental aspect of what I wanted to say. The mental continues today. If I had been able to afford health care, this might not have happened. I would have benefited profoundly from affordable health care. So, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yes. I really appreciate you coming and sharing your story. All right. It's Kelly Howard, not sure about the first name, Kelly Howard, Alberto Moreno, and Michael Canarella. Please proceed.
My name is Kelly Howard, and I'm a glass artist and business owner of a successful glass blowing studio out on the Oregon coast. I came a few years ago, right after Tracy McKeown had had his stroke, and spoke to a council on healthcare reform. And again, I'm here representing, you know, artists that have spent most of their careers without being able to afford health care, including myself, who have children and things. So it's a little bit emotional for me, and I don't do a lot of public speaking. So anyway, I have many examples of artists all around me that have spent a lot of their careers sort of struggling back and forth between health issues that haven't been able to be prevented, that costs taxpayers thousands of dollars. So I agree with the other statements of, you know, can we afford not to do this while there's so many that are not being taken care of, and the cost of all the administrative and things that are costing us money while people are suffering and not having the health care that they need. So I just wanted to be a voice of all those people on the fringe that have spent lots of their careers not being able to afford the health care. And this last year, I was able to provide health insurance for my glass artist, which is a really big deal that I've been wanting to do for a long time, because I went a long time without having health care, back and forth applying for plans for my kids and myself, and then not being able to afford the premium, and then having to have it canceled. And I still have a number of artists that can't, that pay their insurance premiums but actually can't get any care because they can't afford the deductible. So anyway, I think the artists are a group that end up getting kind of pushed out to the edge. And anyway, so I just want to encourage to really seriously try to figure out how to solve this problem, because I think currently the money is going to people who are not, you know, the ones who are in need, which women and children and all of Oregon, all of them. Anyway, so I support the Senate bill 1046, and I hope that it can come to pass.
And thank you. Thank you for sharing your story. I mean, healthcare is a right, and everyone should be able to afford it and to access care. So thank you so much for being here.
Alberto.
Madam Chair, esteemed committee members, for the record, my name is Alberto Moreno, and I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Latino Health Coalition and Chair for the Commission on Hispanic Affairs. As you know, there are approximately 500,000 Latinos who live, pray, and work in Oregon, making Oregon one of the most economically vibrant states in the U.S. While we make significant contributions to the state's economy and pay our fair share of taxes, we are less likely to share equitably in Oregon's opportunities. This is especially true when it comes to being provided with employer-sponsored health care coverage. In fact, Latinos have twice the uninsurance rate as that of their white counterparts, and we are also more likely to suffer significant health disparities, including diabetes, cardiovascular disease, among others. Additionally, our access to healthcare services is more likely to be highly discontinuous and episodic. Because our communities have limited access to care, we often end up using the emergency room as a default means of care. At the Oregon Latino Health Coalition, we begin with a radical belief that everyone should have equitable, dignified access to health care. This is evidenced by our work to make prenatal care a human right for all women in Oregon, which we have done, and for our current effort to pass Cover All Kids in this legislative session. It is for this reason that the Oregon Latino Health Coalition is pleased to support the Health Care for All bill. A publicly financed universal health care system in Oregon will result in substantial administrative simplification in provider offices. It will result in all residents having access to care with roughly the same total cost of the current system, in which 5 to 7% of Oregonians have no care except through emergency room and charity. As a state, I want to say to you that we are better than this. Today, we ask your support for Senate Bill 1046, the Health Care for All bill. Thank you for your time and consideration, as always.
Thank you. All right. Senator Manning, did you want to say a few words? Would you like to come in? And then also the next is, did Michael testify?
No.
Panarella?
I didn't see him.
Lisa Miyamoto and Carlos Crespo. Senator Manning.
Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon. Thank you for having me here, Vice Chair and members of the committee. My name is James Ivory Manning, Jr. For the record, I am a senator of Senate District 7, which is Eugene and Junction City. And I thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to provide a little testimony. And I won't take up a lot of your time because I know that you're getting a lot of information from constituents throughout the state.
Timing you.
You got me on the timer. Okay.
Go, Senator.
I guess you already knew what I was going to do then, so I'll back it up a little bit. But I want to say that I am here to testify in support of SB 1046. I think that it's a long time that we as Oregonians are realizing that there is a population that we have that is deserving of health care. And I am fully support of single payer. I lived in Australia for 3 years, and they have a single payer there. That system worked very well, where no one was turned away for any reason. I look at some. Yesterday, I had 91 grade school students, fourth and fifth graders, come and visit me. And I'm looking at them, and I'm wondering, of all those 91 students, how many don't have access to health care? How many of those are out there just trying to get by? I talked to a young lady today that she's paying astronomical amounts of money, and she can only see a doctor once a year. This is something that we're better than this. As a matter of fact, if we don't do this, then we're this is really hard. We have to do the right thing by the people. So I just want to assure you, colleagues, that when you send this to the floor for a vote, then I will be voting aye for this vote.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, Senator Manning.
Dear distinguished Chairwoman Mona Sanderson and members of the Senate Committee on Health Care, thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony. My name is Carlos Crespo. I'm a professor in the OHSU PSU School of Public Health and also one of the interim associate deans for the School of Public Health. I'm also a former member of the Oregon Health Policy Board and had the pleasure to serve in the Public Health Modernization Task Force. I'm also a member of the board of directors for the Oregon Latino Health Coalition and the Oregon Public Health Institute. I will address some of the deficits of the current system that can be improved by a single-payer system. First, we have to reaffirm our goal that health is a public good and is not a commodity that is based on the ability of an individual to pay. We have done that with education. Education is a public good. We have assurance of 100% access to education. And as a society, we have concluded that we cannot afford an uneducated citizenry, although we're doing a good job at not covering education. But education policy is also health policy. Similarly, we cannot afford to have a sick citizenry. It's not good for business, and it's not good for society. From a policy perspective, it means that we have to change how we pay for health care, and more importantly, how we promote and protect the health of all Oregonians. These are public health principles. The current system has little incentives to keep people healthy. We actually make money out of sick people. An empty bed doesn't make money. And part of that is because the system is designed to charge a fee for services provided. Nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I want to get sick. No parent wakes up in the morning and says, I want my children to be sick. No business have a strategic plan that says, I want my employees to be sick. But we get sick. And the first thing that we think when we get sick is, how am I going to pay for it? In most other places, people think, how am I going to get better? How am I going to get back to work? How quickly can I recover? But that's not what we think. And we have data. Actually, if you have a heart attack next to your spouse, it usually takes 5 minutes longer to get to the emergency room. And probably it's the same discussion. How am I going to pay for this? By establishing a healthcare for all Oregon plan, we can engage in real comprehensive health reform. It would allow us to better allocate funds where they're more effective. It will reduce the burden on business to make health insurance and health benefits packages based on the company's financial circumstances, which is what happened. And we will completely change the interaction between patients and providers. The patients and the provider will have an interaction based on the health condition and is not based on the ability of the patient to pay for the care. I believe that this bill would allow us to move forward, and we'll continue to keep Oregon in the forefront of health reform. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I want to thank you very much for allowing me to testify here today and take part of this democratic process. So thank you all, senators. I'm here with Healthcare for All Oregon. I work for Oregon Health and Sciences University.
Your name for the record?
My name is Lisa Miyamoto. I work for Oregon Health and Sciences University as a registered nurse. I'm not speaking for my hospital, but for myself as a practicing health professional. I've been a nurse for quite some years. I have worked in Iraq, currently in high-risk obstetrics. I have worked in a burn unit, and I've also worked in a medical surgical floor. I've seen a lot of our population come in with diseases that should have been taken care of preventively, like earlier Tracy spoke about not knowing he had high blood pressure and how he could have been helped by just having a primary care doctor and visiting. So I've seen, in turn, these patients that come into me that could have had care taken of them with preventative care. They have gotten sicker. They have lost wages and time at work. They have, in some cases, they have lost their homes. And these are people with health insurance through their jobs. Again, like my fellow here supporting this bill beside me said, when you get sick, you stop and think, how am I going to pay for this? I have a story here for you. A woman in her 40s, a single mother of two children with a very good job and health insurance, after missing work and frequently becoming sick and having shortness of breath and heart palpitations, she decides she's going to go in to see her doctor. Lab tests showed she was severely anemic. She had electrolyte imbalances. She had heavy menstrual cycles and previous stomach surgery. They found out that she was anemic. There was a simple things to do. Some iron infusions on a regular basis, some labs regularly, and a simple day surgery could solve this. She found out, after calling her insurance, that every iron infusion was $250 after insurance paid, and she paid her copayment. She needed 5 of these in a 2-week period to get her body functioning properly again. She was also encouraged to have an outpatient day procedure of surgery to help with her menstrual cycles. That was definitely out of the question. It was $5,000 after health insurance paid. Again, labs needed to get them twice a year. After health insurance paid, the set of labs was between $400 and $600 after her insurance paid. She had to make choices of what to do. She chose the iron infusions. She couldn't afford the other treatment that her doctors had recommended for her to live healthy and productive. To make matters very ironic, she worked for a hospital as a nurse. And I have to tell you, that patient is me, a health professional with a very good job and health insurance. I see people every day who don't get the care they need, and they have health insurance because they can't afford it, or there aren't accessibility to it, like in some of our rural areas. When they do get the health insurance, they have huge medical bills that sometimes they have to take out retirement or pay, or it goes to collections. And this, in turn, hurts our economy. People not being able to get the health insurance they need, this makes all these conditions that could be simple things like maybe $30 to $40 to $50, $100 worth of medication a month, like high blood pressure medication, someone getting treatment for diabetes. I see in my job as in labor and delivery nurse, some of my mothers, they don't get health insurance that takes time to get coverage once they're pregnant, or they move from out of state and come in, and every week counts when you're pregnant. They don't get the tests that they need. That, in turn, they have preterm babies. And those babies stay in our NICU, and they need more care. And those children grow up with some complications. So in the end, us not taking care of our citizens and providing health care for them, it costs all of us. It costs our economy. It costs our children. And it costs our society. So please, I encourage your support of Senate Bill 1046. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, panel. Right. Charlie Swanson, Mike Sullivan, and Ricardo Small. And I those are the only ones I have on my list. And, okay.
Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. I'm Charlie Swanson, a healthcare and democracy advocate testifying in support of Senate Bill 1046. There is a joke about publicly funded healthcare. A recently deceased advocate, upon being admitted to heaven, was permitted to ask a question of the Almighty. "Will the United States ever have universal health care?" she asked. "Oh, yes," God replied, "but not in my lifetime." Those of us in Healthcare for All Oregon are working to make it happen sooner, beginning by getting a system functioning in Oregon. We think health care should be treated as a public good, provided as needed to those in Oregon in a manner similar to public education, public roads, police protection, fire protection. The RAND report, as you heard earlier, projects that doing so could allow everyone in Oregon to be covered with the same single risk pool with essentially no financial barriers to care for essentially the same cost as our current system. RAND documents that the average administrative savings with a single-payer system reported in state and national studies is 11% of total costs. And this is, they didn't say that today, but this is in their report. But RAND goes on to project, this would be about $4 billion in Oregon. But RAND goes on to project only about $1 billion in administrative savings. This $3 billion discrepancy is matched by the decrease in provider reimbursement assumed by RAND. So we suspect their bottom line is about correct. But rather than primarily reflecting reduced provider income, we think the decreased reimbursement will lead to roughly the same net income for providers because of the administrative efficiencies available in a single-payer model. As you heard from other people, it's a lot simpler in a provider office if there's only one payer. Healthcare is not a normal market commodity. When you're having a heart attack or as you are lying unconscious in your car after an accident, you cannot shop around. There is substantial information in asymmetry. Few patients have as much knowledge as their providers. Health insurers, as third-party payers, cannot lead us to an affordable market solution. Even the famed conservative economist Friedrich Hayek essentially said as much. Ask yourself, how much would you pay for health care necessary to save your child's life? Oregon should take the next step towards universal health care after the RAND study on health care financing. We should work together to create a plan to put before Oregon voters, a publicly funded plan based on a single-payer model with a single risk pool, including all Oregon providers in a single network. Healthcare will continue to grow more unaffordable until we do. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Good afternoon, Chair Monts Anderson and committee members. For the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I am the political director for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers. AWPPW supports SB 1046 and the concept of a single-payer plan. A brief history lesson. In 1945, Harry Truman came with a national health care plan. It was defeated. Part of the problem was that large unions, like the United Auto Workers, didn't support it because they had health care through their employers. Although Walter Reuther, the renowned leader, was really for it, he couldn't move his membership. That plan was, seen with LBJ's Medicare. But we need to finish the job. The term disposable income means what you have left after you pay your bills to clothe, feed, and house yourself. If we could eliminate the costs of health care, there would be more money in the local economies, and in particular in rural areas. This would be heaven sent. On a personal note, I have a very good friend. This is 11th week in the hospital to the right of me, Salem Hospital, at a mere, and I'm being conservative, $1,000 a day. That's about $77,000. He's a working stiff. I doubt he'll ever come out with the cancer. But if he does, certainly the bill will kill him. This country has now spent another $54 billion on the quest of endless war. I really do believe we could do better with our tax dollars for the citizens of our country. We need a single health payer plan in this country. Thank you very much, and I'll answer any questions that you might have.
All right, thank you. Okay, questions? Ricardo is not here. Ricardo Small. All right, does anyone else? We have a couple of minutes. Anyone else want to testify? Do you want to come forward? And you'll be you will play a cleanup.
Thank you, sir. Mark Humer. Madam Chair, for the record, is this on? Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Pete Lee. I am supporting Health Care for All Oregon, and it's an honor to speak with you briefly. I've been a volunteer EMT for about 20 years, and my passion for doing this work as a volunteer is driven by the fact that my parents were immigrants from Korea 45 years ago. My family's wealth was taken away from us, and my father begged for food in the streets of Korea when he was 12, after having lost his dad. We were very fortunate to move to Oregon, where a community came around us. They surrounded us with love and support. We started small businesses. My family is financially successful. But the reason why I'm here today is because, going back to why I volunteer as an EMT, is because my family experienced dignity. And you know, I know that I may have disagreements with some of you, Senator Knopp, we are from different parties, but you know, at the end of the day, if anything were to happen to you, I would treat you. I don't care if there's a D or an R on your voter registration card. I treat you because you all deserve dignity. And so please, I urge you to pass this bill and give Oregonians the dignity they deserve. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And colleagues, this bill is not moving. It's past the deadline, and it isn't informational. But it was so important, since we had that report, we had this bill, that we wanted to dedicate this day to it. And once we get the leadership and the legislature and the governor all on board, who knows what the future will hold for better health care for all. So thank you very much. Any comments, questions? We're adjourned.
That's a really